Hello and welcome to the Civic Tech in Africa podcast. We're so happy to have you join us again for another installment of our podcast. I'm excited about being back with you and hope you found the previous episode as informative and as interesting as we think it was. In the previous episode, I said we have a very high quality guest lined up for you, or really high quality guest lined up for you. And I think we're still on track to deliver on that promise. Today's guest is an amazing one, and we'll be covering an important discussion in the civic tech space on the continent. Can't wait to talk to him, but later we'll try and define user-centered design and explain why it's so important for people in the civic tech space. But first, let's get it ready to talk to our guest right after this. Welcome back. Today, we're talking about e-participation in matters of governance across the African continent, and more specifically about what happens when government agencies embrace digital technologies as a way to connect with their constituents. Paul Plantinger joins me today to talk about the use of digital platforms in public participation, as well as some interesting work he's doing with the Human Sciences Research Council. Paul is a senior research manager at the HSRC in South Africa. He is currently leading projects on digital policy and platforms and on evidence-informed policy making. I'd like to welcome Paul. Hi, Paul. How are you doing?
I'm great. Hi.
I'm so happy that you joined us. Obviously, you are an expert in public participation or participatory governance issues. And I'd like you to paint the picture for us. What does the landscape of participatory governance look like in South Africa, where you work, and more broadly on the African continent? Do you have an idea of, like, governments, what are they doing right now in as far as governance is rather participation is concerned?
Yeah, firstly to say, I wouldn't call myself an expert in participatory governance. I come from a technology background and have found myself working in a couple of areas. One of them is around participatory governance and the relationship between citizens and residents of a country and policy and government decision makers. From our perspective and some of the work we've been involved in, what we do see is your more general rhythm of participation in public processes. And that's things like your integrated development plans, which are reviewed every year, your bylaws that are also reviewed or created on a somewhat regular basis. And those usually involve your typical consultation meetings, those kinds of things that again happen throughout the year. And then I suppose there are the more dedicated resourcing for participation activities for things like, for example, national health insurance, where you have a quite large-scale participation program that the National Assembly runs to reach out to people across the country. And then, of course, it's in a more localized sense, so things like environmental impact assessments where specific communities are engaged on specific issues. But I think what's possibly more interesting in recent times, and it's probably always existed, is your governance experimentation, your engagement experimentation more from the bottom up. So your civil society-led initiatives, those kinds of things that right. A number of organizations are doing in the country and that are part of the civic tech network that we see at your conferences, those kinds of places. I think from an Africa perspective, although we don't have a huge amount of visibility into it, we do like to follow what's been happening. So that's why actually the conference last year, the Civic Tech Innovation Forum, was quite useful to engage with some of the people that have similar interests and work to us. And I'm thinking of things like what the Open Institute has been doing around the county dashboards, the Open County work in Kenya, seeing in Tanzania around the JAMI forums. Those are all initiatives that we weren't necessarily familiar with. And of course, they're a little bit more tech-oriented, but they're good examples of where there seems to be quite high levels of engagement that have developed somewhat organically, and perhaps they're not necessarily engaging directly with government or, you know, government policy processes, but they seem to be quite significant platforms for capturing what the public feels about issues that could be relevant to government decision-making if it was, for example, integrated in a more formal way or recognized in a more formal sense by your public policy actors. And then a lot of what we see is through the open government partnership and what's kind of captured through the national action plans and the reporting on the OGP activities. And what's nice to see in those in other parts of the continent is the multi-stakeholder forum and multi-stakeholder platforms that have been established. And it's hard to say, of course, whether those are working or not. We all know the challenges in that space, but I think it is interesting to see the progress there, as well as the interest, especially in local, OGP local, and localizing a lot of the OGP-related initiatives around, say, open data or using digital platforms to support engagement, those kinds of things. So, yeah, that's pretty much the insight we have for now.
What I'm hearing is that a lot of people are sort of embracing digital platforms as a way to engage with citizens. Is that sort of where the landscape of participation is right now, where a lot more government agencies are using technology as a way to engage with their citizens?
I suppose that's the lens we're seeing it through, and it's probably distorted.
Right.
I think the reality is, and we can probably come to that in a second, is the vast majority is still being done through relatively traditional processes. So, your town hall Izimbizo type meetings in community halls, those kinds of things. So from our perspective, yes, but I think the reality is much closer to how things have been done for the last 50 years or so.
And so if it brings me to a very interesting question around, you know, who has access then? If more and more people are moving towards, you know, participating using digital technologies, we know that Africa has a very big access issue, right? And a lot of people don't have access to digital technologies. Who do you leave out, you know, during those participation processes? If a lot more we are moving towards that, you know, because I think that's what you're reading in the space, that a lot of people are going, okay, we're going to use technology now as a way. And I imagine it's effective, but, you know, do we leave people out, or are we using very dual processes as a way to engage citizens?
Yeah, so I suppose the first question is to ask to what extent the digital processes and platforms are supporting any form of meaningful engagement. And I'm not sure there's clear evidence for that at a significant scale yet, even in any specific population groups. And I'm talking more about the formal connection. I think certainly, for example, social media has become quite powerful from a number of perspectives. So, for example, political organizing, since the Arab Spring days demonstrated potential to support those kinds of movements and the emergence of those kinds of movements. It's used, I think, quite extensively for interaction in South Africa and discussion of social and policy issues. So I think that's certainly significant. The bigger question, as I mentioned, is whether that really finds its way into any kind of formal public policy processes. So as one example, I suppose where it was potentially interesting is that during the COVID days, there was a lot of interest in sentiment analysis on social media from a government perspective and kind of tracking the mood in across different issues. So then, yeah, perhaps there's an example there of kind of just harvesting sentiment and policy commentary or social media as a first, I suppose, an initial attempt to start connecting what's been happening more organically with what happens more formally in terms of government decision-making. I think, yeah, perhaps later we get to some of the details of the kind of inclusion, exclusion.
I think that's very interesting because, you know, when I was thinking about e-participation, I'm thinking about it as a process driven by people in government. But from what you're saying there is that sometimes it's sort of a chaotic process where people are sort of expressing how they feel about a certain thing. And then there's a whole process where people who are, you know, involved in policymaking will then harvest that information to inform, you know, whatever policy they want to engage in. I'm sort of very interested in how organized, you know, digital participation is, right? Because in my head, I'm like, okay, participation needs to be organized. We need to get a lot of people involved in grassroots. But it seems to me like it's quite a chaotic process sometimes. And sometimes it can be quite, you know, organized, particularly if it's coming from a very top-down approach. If it's a bottom-up approach, it can be quite chaotic. And sort of what do you think is the most effective way of engaging people?
Yeah, I think a couple of examples I suppose I've commented on now are your more chaotic spaces where governments are, say, trying to harvest, as you say. But the reality, and I think the origins of e-participation, I mean, as a very old term and probably overused term, were the much more structured forms of participation where, you know, from a basic perspective, you know, the government entity or a municipality would publish some draft policy or bylaw on their website and then have a form to make comments. And then, it's then a much more structured process. And it's helpful, I suppose, for a municipality, because in the content they're receiving, they can kind of guide the nature of the content that they're receiving towards specific questions, for example. So I think that the challenge with those traditional kind of top-down processes as they've historically been run is, I suppose, just the numbers of engagement probably have not been, especially in South Africa and other parts, have not been at the levels that they would like. But there are various other issues, and those other issues are connected to more underlying fundamentals of the role of participatory processes in a representative democracy, as an example. So if those underlying challenges are not addressed and you stick technology on top of it, then the technology doesn't really make any difference. And I think that in South Africa's case, it's a classic example of a few dynamics affecting people's interest in participation in general. So one is participation a valid form of influencing decision making when you have representatives who've been elected to represent our interests? And I think law is fairly clear around, the balance between the two, and that participation doesn't necessarily mean that it will change the decisions that have been made by the representatives. And then there are, of course, other issues. So people don't really know what they're participating in. So a lot of the participation processes are, for example, around strategic planning on a 5-year horizon. And in most cases, people are just trying to get specific service delivery addressed. And then there's politicization of processes, which is, I think, well known in South Africa, and all ultimately kind of leads to non-participation, whether it's physical or online.
In my head, I was actually talking to this with a friend about whether or not we feel people who represent us in government actually do represent us. And you're saying to me that, in fact, perhaps, our opinions don't really make it to policy because sometimes it's the representatives that go. And I always worry about where they take their information from. And are they taking their information from people who are very politically involved? And so that sort of bias towards people who are very, very much involved in politics and things like that. I think you've sort of touched on my next question around what the challenges of public participation is, right? What are some of the challenges that you're seeing on the African continent, particularly in online participation? You've spoken about the over-politicization of that process. But I can think of, the marketing of certain ideas, right? Like if I'm trying to write a policy on something, most people don't know about that, right? And they don't know where to participate. I think so. That's one of the challenges I can think about. So, like, I don't really get to participate in matters of governance because I don't know when I should participate or where I should participate, So that for me is one of the challenges. Can you think of any others?
Yeah, I think that's a critical one. It's kind of that process literacy. So I suppose the starting point is knowing why it matters. But then there's also process literacy. So knowing at what points in the policy cycle making inputs would be most meaningful. Of course, there are those formal periods where there's the 30 or 60 day period where a consultation must happen, which I think is, of course, important. The comment you made earlier, a second ago, about where do, for example, representatives get information for their own work? Where does that information come from? And I think that's an interesting example of how we potentially need to think about things. And it's not so much our active submission of, say, proposals or comments, but perhaps making the information available to those decision makers that perhaps they're not aware of, and to support their own decision-making as representatives of us. And that's just as an aside, I think that reinforces the importance of electoral processes and participation in elections, given the current period we're in. Just to comment on those two, I think information, and then that leads to, I suppose, one of the challenges which underlies public participation as well as representative processes is the access to useful information, meaningful information for everyone. So I can't make a meaningful comment on the IDP if it's impossible for me to really work through that document and understand what all the different kind of elements of it are and how they're connected and how that connects with the budget and whether my input at that specific point in time is what's going to, for example, lead to adjustments in the budget that can benefit me. Because from a process literacy perspective, it might not be the right point in the cycle for me to be able to change how the budget is allocated. So, yeah, I think as a starting point, digestible information is an important one. And that's why a lot of, I think, the open government and open government work has focused a lot around open data and opening data, because I think a lot of us have felt that that's where should start. Then that's not necessarily correct, but I think it's certainly one of the foundational elements of getting this working. And then I think what a lot of other people are doing around those kind of community-based processes, activities around asset-based community development, community-based planning, et cetera, are the, I think then are the more fundamental social processes that are needed to really activate the use of that information. So I think connecting those two are probably a great entry point in this space.
Right. So I just want to move on to sort of your work with municipalities right now, obviously with the HSRC. We've seen you at the conference of the Civic Tech Innovation Forum for a number of years, engaging with, you know, people representing municipalities across, you know, the country. I'm very interested, just from a person who's kind of jealous of what's happening in that room that I can't access, but what happens in those rooms and sort of what are some of the conversations that are coming out and what sort of are the interesting takes that people have from those conversations? So I'm very curious. Just give me a little bit of like, what are you guys talking about?
Yeah, sure. It's not meant to be a closed space necessarily, although we do like to create a bit of a safe space for municipality officials to speak to each other. I think that's necessary. But I think the main reason that we supported or encouraged municipality official involvement at CTIF is to meet with some of the civic tech community, which I don't think those conversations happen as much as they should, and that learning happens as much as it should. But yeah, just to go back a step, so that project is a project that we're leading under the Department of Science and Innovation with EU and Treasury funding to support the piloting of e-participation in roughly 6 or 7 municipalities around South Africa. As I say, e-participation is quite an old concept and old space that has to some extent resurfaced for us under this initiative. I think the important thing for us is recognizing that because a lot of municipalities have moved on with their lives around using tools like websites and social media, and they've played around a lot with that space, that we have to do this in a much more reflective way with especially the officials that are involved, and to say, you know, what are you currently using? What has worked? What are your experiences been with, say, using Facebook to share updates on what you're doing and to get comments on something like an IDP? And some have and some haven't, and they've had good and bad experiences. So, for example, some have shut down comments on their Facebook groups because they just find it too abusive and so not helpful to them or, in their view, to the community. So, yeah, the project itself is quite top-down in that we are starting with the municipalities rather than some of our other projects, and as you do, working, I suppose, more from the bottom up with civic civil society organizations. So for us, it's quite nice to work with the municipalities themselves and to look at it from their perspective around how do they run their, say, their IDP process or an open, you know, a bylaw review, and then what are their issues, and then to explore them together with them. And the reason we connected with CTIF is that because then it's also an opportunity for us to have multiple municipalities in a room together and to just share with each other what has worked over the past decade in linking their online with their offline processes, and to see how that can move things forward in a, it's a very kind of incremental, iterative way in reality, what we're seeing. So yeah, that project is a few more months, well, until I suppose mid next year. So yeah, we're looking to really just make some progress there in supporting municipalities take these things forward themselves and to work right as much as possible with tools that are available within their existing IT environment, and that can plug into their existing participation processes relatively right easily. What we've also found is also to be a little bit more, I suppose, user-driven. I think that's one of the big shifts, is that because of the, you know, the original days, a lot of the e-participation projects were designed as, you know, building a web platform and then deploying it and then running a process with officials. And that would often be done with like a strong presence from the IT department. Whereas now, because of a lot of the cloud-based tools being available, a lot more can be done from the user perspective and kind of from a user-driven approach. You know, users can experiment with tools like Canva and Google Forms and quite quickly set up their own online consultation arrangement without even having to ask IT to set these things up on the website formally.
Yeah, I think what you're talking about is obviously, why don't you actually just properly introduce the project that you're talking about? Because also you're launching it this year. So I hear the e-participation and policy modeling platform for South Africa. You've touched a little bit on that. Is there anything else you want to sort of expand on why that project is important for the HSRC?
Yeah, so from the HSRC perspective, we're traditionally a research organization and our bread and butter is running nationally representative surveys as a social science humanities research organization. For us, this is quite new to be in because there's much more of an emphasis here on then implementing processes and tools to support changes in how, for example, in this case, municipalities go about things. So for us, there's two real interests. We're interested in, of course, how participation and democracy can work slightly differently, with the use of digital platforms from a research perspective. But also we're interested in how the HSRC can support more implementation-oriented projects that can actually impact how people interact. And yeah.
From this project, you are launching a toolkit, because I wanted to ask earlier about, you know, is there a blueprint that you sort of, from your engagements with people in municipalities, that you've gone, okay, this is what we've learned from what they've shared with us, and these are some of the lessons that people can sort of take from. Do you have a blueprint that you've developed from these conversations?
There is some expectation from a funder perspective for kind of frameworks and blueprints in that sense. But I think it's, again, just going back to kind of the early days of e-participation, you'll see if you look at the academic literature, there's a lot of frameworks and blueprints that have been developed from a, you know, whether from a process or an architecture perspective. And some of them are very detailed. From our perspective, and that's why we've just tried to start documenting things in a toolkit, is that it's approached in a slightly different way in the sense that rather than a toolkit, we're seeing more the need or the desire for municipalities to assemble different ideas and capabilities based on specific needs. So, for example, if they're running a Facebook group and they're having issues with the types of comments, etc., then the capability or the need that they're trying to address is how to better moderate the conversations that are happening on their Facebook page. So they don't necessarily have guidelines or a policy that their social media manager or their comms person can follow to know whether they can, for example, delete a comment or exclude someone from a conversation, because that's just not been done before. So that might be a more of a soft capability that they just, and a small, relatively small action that can be introduced so that there's more transparency around how the conversation, social media conversation, is moderated. And then the people who are moderating it are more confident that they can, for example, delete an abusive comment. So then the same applies to different areas of online participation, like identity verification, etc., making information available. How can you make that information available in more accessible formats? Then there are capabilities at a slightly higher level, like managing the end-to-end process. If a municipality is, for example, wanting to have tighter control over an online public participation process, then they may want to have an end-to-end management platform that can integrate all the phases of participation. And then that's a capability that they might want to establish in the form of a formal platform. So yeah, the toolkit is a little bit more structured around highlighting specific capabilities or tools that could be introduced or assembled together. So you may want to address identity verification as well as moderation as two capabilities that you want to bring into your existing environment and the way you do public participation. And then you can just learn from what other countries or cities have done from that perspective.
Right. Yeah,
so just much more focused on capabilities and specific tools that you could bring in.
Fantastic. Just in case I've missed anything, do you have anything sort of you're working on that you'd like listeners and viewers to know about?
Maybe to clarify one point, so the project's been running for a while, but we're really starting the kind of initial phases of implementation now with municipalities and starting to see some of the, you know, the experiences and some initial results. It's very early stage of some of the actions we're working with them on. So from that perspective, this is quite an important period for us. And I think hopefully we are part of the next CTIF, where we can also share a little bit more. And also hopefully we would be able to have future meetings where municipalities are able to come together to, again, update each other on what they've been doing, as well as to meet with some of the civic tech community, because that's, I think, an important learning space for all of us. So, yeah, just from a progress perspective, I think the next 12 months would be good just to keep connecting with the community CTIN.
On the show notes, so our listeners will be able to access the website to DHSRC and more specifically the project that you're working on, the toolkit as well. So, you know, our listeners, just go to show notes and you'll access DHSRC's website and other information. Thank you so much for joining us, Paul. I feel like we don't have enough time to actually discuss the things that I really want to discuss because our podcast is really short. But yeah, thank you so much for joining us for such an important discussion for people in the civic space. We're going to wrap right here and we will be back for part three of the podcast. Welcome back. Joining us for the segment is Jono Bozeman. Jono is a program manager at Open Up. He is a lead empathist with a background in psychology and product development. He uses his skills, combining research and user-centered design thinking to inform products that make civic participation easier. He believes civic tech is one of the best ways to make a positive impact in the world. As I said at the beginning of the podcast, he's going to be defining another term for us, right? This is our new segment that we're doing. What in the civic tech? And today, I'm asking the question, what is user-centered design? And Jono is an expert in this area. So I want to say hello to Jono quickly. Hi, Jono.
Good morning, Nati.
Morning, Jono. Jono, can you tell us a little bit about what the idea of user-centered design is and why is it important for people in our space?
User-centered design is the approach to product development that focuses and centers users as the primary importance for the information. So instead of going and collecting a lot of research, maybe desktop research or speaking to experts, we look at the user. I mean, and sometimes experts can be the central user of a tool, but it's focusing and centering all the development around their needs, preferences, and behaviors. So that at the end of the day, when we're developing products, we are focusing on who is going to be using that product as our primary person.
Right. And I think it's something we speak about a lot on this podcast. We've spoken a little bit about how language, which is my favorite topic, really, how language is important as a way to make the product that you are developing accessible. Can you think of other ways, for instance, that are, and I know I'm just springing this question on you, other ways where you feel that when a product has that, it sort of is a user-centered product, right? Because I know that if you're using the right language, for instance, for people in rural areas probably don't have the big words in their vocabulary, it's a way to make it accessible. What other ways can you think of that are sort of user-centered rather?
Yeah, so I think an important part of user-centered design is it comes at multiple stages of a project. So it can be in the inception of a project to understand the different perspectives, goals, and challenges of the users. So generally, when we're designing any sort of product or tool, it has some sort of a need that you're trying to address using that tool. So by speaking directly with the affected parties or people that you're building this tool to help, you can gain a lot of kind of information at the inception of a project. You also can define limitations of those specific users. So I think you mentioned language there. I think it's important to go and speak to the users and see what language are they speaking, and then you can design your tool around that. Maybe when you speak to users, you're seeing that it's multiple languages. So you want to go with a more illustrative heavy tool on your side that doesn't have as much complicated languages. So I think it all depends. It's hard to define without having a specific tool in mind what you're building, because I think user bases can vary so much. But it's really just to ensure that your tool is intuitive, useful, and enjoyable for the user to use. Because at the end of the day, whatever you design, right, you want users to be coming back and using that thing.
Yeah, and I think you've answered that last question that I had about how innovators in the civic tech space can best apply the concept of user design or user-centered design, rather, in their work. And you said, like, you have to understand the user before actually undertaking the development of that product. Am I correct in that assessment?
Yeah, I could add a few more points to that. So I think the upfront user research that I spoke to really helps you define the needs and behaviors of your user base or of the people that you're designing the tool for, and also kind of gives you a better understanding of their preferences. I think in user-centered design, empathy is also a huge, an impactful kind of byproduct of that. Understanding what's going to motivate your users to use the tool, understanding their goals, but also really understanding the pain points and the challenges that they're experiencing and why you're designing the tool to kind of help them. Iterative design is also another important part of it. So throughout the user-centered design process, we want to constantly check in with our users. So if we develop kind of what we call wireframes, which are minimal viable product designs, you can show users and see if you're on the right track. Because at the end of the day, I think the worst is to put a lot of time and money into designing a tool, but then at the end of the day, the users don't use it. So by using user-centered design process, it helps you avoid that because you're constantly checking in and getting feedback from users and making changes. It helps with accessibility and inclusivity. So what we really want is a tool that kind of speaks to diverse backgrounds and that anyone can use. So when you're doing your user-centered research or design methodology, you can conduct interviews with multiple, and it doesn't only have to be interviews, but with multiple different kind of target audience or expected users of the tool to ensure that it doesn't meet the needs of only one kind of demographic, but meets the needs of everybody who you envision to use the tool. And then I think the last thing is kind of this co-creation idea of getting buy-in from your user base. If it was something that's designed by the people for the people, I think there's always a much higher chance that people are going to use the tool. So yeah, this co-creation throughout the process is an important one for me.
I'm very happy with us defining the concept and talking about what sort of applications, you know, civic tech innovators can, you know, how can they best apply the concept for their work. I'm very thankful for you joining us in this segment. That's John Bosman. Thank you so much.
Cool. Thanks, Nati. Have a great rest of your day.
All right. I always say on this podcast, please go check out our website where we have our database of organizations from across the continent working on different parts of the civic tech space, right? So visit civictech.africa to see all the initiatives and also the evidence map that's on our website. So go check out the website. But also, I want to say a welcome to everybody who's watching us on YouTube today. Please follow and subscribe. And also, don't forget to write comments. If you have any questions for us, please write them on the comment section below. If you want to rate us on Spotify and Apple Podcasts, please go ahead. Give us a 5-star rating, please. And we'll see you in the next episode. Goodbye. See you later.